Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Michael Harris, number 38714. I represent Barry Ross. And what I'd really like to start out talking about is the third issue in my brief regarding the credibility. Partly because it seems like this is an ongoing issue in Colorado. It used to seem it was a clear-cut rule. You don't ask a witness, tell us if the other witness is telling the truth. It used to be something that was taught to, I think, everyone in law school, and it's been around for decades. And it seems like the prosecution in various cases, including this case, is trying to get acceptance, trying to get to the point where the exception gets rid of the basic rule. And they're trying to do that through, well, we're not directly saying, witness A, please tell us if witness B is telling the truth or not. They're doing other things. They're talking about probable cause, for example, which Mullen said he can't do that. And in this case, they're talking about where the kids live. They're asking the family about how do you feel about these things. And then it's in the interrogation tape. And I understand that, especially for the interrogation tape, unfortunately, there was not a specific objection to take it out of that, but that's why we have a plain error review standard. And for example, in People v. Mullins, where they talked about probable cause, that was so egregious that plain error required reversal. The same thing should happen in this case.
Mr. Harris, with all due respect, your argument is almost as confusing to me as parts of your brief. Can you tell us exactly what witness said what things that you assert vouch for the credibility of another witness? Rather than generalities, tell us specifically, and if there was an objection to it.
Yeah, well,
we'll give us a few examples anyway.
Well, the interrogation tape is a big one with the detective, and where the detective is repeatedly throughout the interrogation saying, I have overwhelming evidence, you're obviously lying. That's the main thing, which would be Exhibit 30.
This is the detective speaking to the defendant and commenting right in the interrogation tape that he doesn't believe the defendant's story.
Exactly. That would be the main area, or one of the main areas, I should say, that comes up. And they bring up, in addition, when they have the sexual assault expert, Mr. Christensen, saying it's rare that children would lie, showing it, which in the case of People v. Snook said, you cannot do that.
Is that what he said exactly? Wasn't the question, in your experience, have you found that children have lied? There's some back and forth. And
right.
He said no. In his experience, have you found that children have lied? He didn't say that these children lied.
Well, he specifically said, I do not comment on this specific case.
Isn't that end the issue?
Excuse me, sir?
Doesn't that end the issue if the expert expressly disclaims opining on the credibility of the victim or victims in this case?
No, sir, because that's also saying in general this doesn't happen. Children don't lie in general is prohibited. People v. Snook talked about it. So that does not end the issue. And in this case, they're trying to line up facts of this case in a hypothetical, basically leading the witness down, saying this is all consistent, children barely lie, and going into that, or have you found children lie? So that does not end the issue. That's basically the same thing. And it's not just one thing, it's they do things over and over. They talk to the family witnesses about where the children living. And it's also, this is overlapped with the closing argument, where they emphasize this. They don't say, well, this is only for a purpose that's permissible. They basically say, throughout the closing argument, the prosecution goes into the family believes the children. Look at, and that overlaps again with the body language. So there's a lot of different things. It is confusing because it happens so often. It wasn't just one bad thing that happened during the trial, and that was the end of it. It happened in different areas with the same basic subject.
Did you argue cumulative error in your opening brief as a separate basis for reversal?
I don't know, I didn't create that as a separate issue, but I do believe that in the brief, and especially the reply brief, I mentioned that when it happens over and over, that is an issue. So I didn't create a whole separate section, but I did summarize things saying, look, this happened over and over. It wasn't one mistake. So in this case, we have all these problems. And also, I was also to think about the potential consequences if we go into creating these exceptions and expanding them to allow this type of thing to happen in cases. First, with regard to the interrogation video, and I understand that People vs. Davis has come out recently saying in that case, we can explain how the interrogation went and they allow things. That was very specific. It was not, in all cases, anything in the video goes. Period. They didn't say that. That was a specific issue, and the Supreme Court opinion doesn't go into all the facts as much, but the Court of Appeals opinion talks a little more about the facts. That was a specific thing where the defense was going into why the detective did certain things. That did not happen in Mr. Ross's case. It was just presented. And when you watch the video, they didn't present it this way, but you can think about it when you're watching it. Take out these parts in the video of, I have overwhelming evidence, you're obviously lying. If you imagine watching without that, the legitimate parts are not degraded in any way, shape, or form. The defendant's statements are still there, exactly the same. They're not taken out of context if you were to delete those parts. So it doesn't really mean it's necessary.
Trial counsel didn't request that the interrogation tape be edited?
That's correct. They did not. And obviously that's unfortunate. And there's a lot of areas that it would have been better for them to object. That's why we still have a plain error review. Not objecting doesn't mean we waive it, and too bad. It means it's still a plain error if it's so significant.
All right. We also have an ineffective assistance of counsel remedy in 35C if plain error didn't work. Is that correct?
Exactly, and if we do not prevail here, I'm sure we're going to be doing that route, of course. But at the same time, do we need to get there? When you have something happening over and over, as in several cases, that should be plain error. And frankly, the judge at some point should step in and say, wait a minute, this isn't right. And even the prosecution, they're just because you can strike foul blows, to change the expression a little bit, doesn't mean you should. And this kept happening. And just think about the idea if it's in the interrogation, anything goes. What else could you throw in there? Can we talk about polygraphs? Can we talk about criminal history? Can you say, well, you were meeting your mother or something? I mean, how far can you go? Just because it's in a tape during an interrogation does not automatically mean it comes in.
No, but there's an arguable ground for why some of those statements would come in, and if they're not raised to the trial court, what's the trial court supposed to do with it? I mean, there's an arguable ground as to why the detective would have been using such language under the Davis case. And when you say, like, well, it wasn't supported or argued that way, there was no issue ever made of it.
Right. And I know it's still binding, obviously, at the time of trial, Davis hadn't been out, but even if it had been out, that once the judge saw these things and saw talking about overwhelming evidence, I don't know that that is an arguable issue that should be admissible. There's no need for the detective to tell the jury, whether directly or through a tape, about overwhelming evidence.
No, but I thought the rationale of the Davis case was it's an investigative technique.
Right.
It's not a lie detector statement. It's an investigative technique to try to prod someone into an answer or further investigation. So that would not have been arguably within this realm of investigative technique. Perhaps if it had been raised, perhaps if they'd have been able to address it, something might have been done, but the prosecution can't defend it, and the trial court doesn't get a chance to rule on it.
Well, what the judge saw, it could have, and the prosecution should have probably not done it in the first place. They should have said, hey, we're taking this out. That's the higher duty of the prosecutor. And Davis, the defense, made an issue out of it. They made an issue to the, when going after the detective of why you did these things. And Mr. Ross's case, the defense did not make an issue of why did you do these things. So that's completely different. Davis looks like the exception, not establishing a new rule or saying it. So that's completely different. Since my time is getting close, I want to kind of move on to another issue. One issue which really is unheard of, the fifth issue, where they're talking about during cross-examination, didn't the son say something? And it's hard to really come up with specific cases because that's just such an unusual thing. The People vs. Pratt case tells about innuendo and going into issues that...
All right, but now there an objection was raised, correct?
Right.
The trial court granted the objection.
Right, and this...
Correct?
It was objected to.
No sustained. No cautionary instruction was requested, correct?
Exactly.
A motion for mistrial was not made.
Correct.
Right. So... what exactly is the error that occurred on the basis of which you're suggesting we reverse?
That the jury can't put that aside.
No. That's not an error. Is the error that the trial court did not sua sponte declare a mistrial?
I think that's one issue, yes.
Well, don't tell me one issue. What error is it that's the basis for reversal?
Well, there could have been a sua sponte, if not instruction, a mistrial, like you said. That was just such a unusual
Okay,
thing.
Well, is that your argument that the trial court erred in not sua sponte declaring?
Yes. And, or at least had a discussion about it and said, just move on. And that is something so significant. To ask a jury to set aside, hey, there's an independent witness out there who, in this case, there wasn't even a factual basis to think there was when they had the approach of the bench and said, well, where did this come from? It wasn't exactly the case at all. That's like asking a jury to set aside and disregard hearing about pink elephants, as the kind of example goes. That's just not possible. So that is something that's unusual. There's not going to be probably any cases on that, at least I can find that specific thing, because it's just almost unimaginable for someone to cross-examine and mentioning a witness who's not even a witness, who's not there, and having to comment about it. It's just a highly odd situation. Let's kind of go on to, as with the closing arguments, I talked a little bit about that already, about how to emphasize some of the admissible areas. And they specifically asked about sympathy. And I mean, that can't be more clear-cut than using that word, which is, of course, not allowed. It was very emotional. This is an emotional case, obviously. Even the people who have seen these type of cases have a hard time hearing about these type of allegations without your stomach turning. I mean, the allegations are awful. And the issue, of course, is did they happen? And was it a fair trial? So when you link that type of thing up to this emotional testimony of talking about how the girls are crying, it's almost impossible for someone to set that aside and to expect a 12-person jury who are obviously not lawyers, not familiar with these type of things, to set that aside is simply not something you can expect. To move on a little bit to the issue with the speedy trial, I don't want to gloss over that too much, but in this case, I'm not saying you can never extend speedy trial, certainly that can be done, but there needs to be facts of doing that and not, well, maybe it would be nice to extend speedy trial. In this case, we had the issue with the older victim being pregnant and the letter from the doctor saying, well, it would be better, but there wasn't anything specific. There wasn't a situation where she was having complications or there was some medical reason. If there was, that would be a good reason, as Giovanna said. In this case, it was, you know, it'd be better. That's really not enough reason to extend the speedy trial time.
Was there a motion to dismiss the case?
There was not.
And doesn't the law say there has to be?
Depends how you read it, honestly. I don't blame the Attorney General for raising that issue, because it does have the words in the statute, file the motion. As mentioned in my reply brief, it's understandable why they would miss that. The judge already ruled. Why should you file a motion when the judge already made a ruling? Does it really mean anything in this situation? Obviously, that might be another issue.
Well, objecting to a continuance and moving to dismiss for a speedy trial are two very different things, I would have to think. That's why the statute has the language in it.
I don't know if that is why the statute has the language in this particular case, because what would be the point? The judge already said it's okay, so what would be the point of being a motion? If that is absolutely required, then that would really be a per se ineffective assistance, and we're going to get there anyway. And I don't know if you'd let me go on, I see my time's out.
Yeah, your time's up.
Okay, thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Allen. I'm here on behalf of the people. I'd like to start out just by talking about credibility generally. And as this court is aware, in sex assault on children cases, the main issue is almost always, are the kids telling the truth? I mean, that's what it comes down to. It comes down to the credibility of the witnesses. And there was nothing improper done by the prosecutor in this case. For the most part, the prosecution was responding to doors that were opened by the defense in some of their questioning of the witnesses. Particularly, the detective, the defense attorney went on in the cross-examination. This is on January 31st, starting at page 106. And you had specialized training in interrogation and sex crimes. Yes, and you interrogated Mr. Ross. Yes, and the goal of your interrogation was to get Mr. Ross to confess. And then you go on talking about all of the different techniques that the detective used. And then on redirect is when the prosecution went into why the detective did what the detective did. I mean, the prosecutor has a right to go into these areas, especially if, the defense is implying that he was being pushy and just trying to get the defendant to confess.
I presume that the interrogation video was played before defense counsel cross-examined the detective.
Yes, because it was played on direct.
Sure.
Okay. I believe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what's the justification for recognizing review would be plain error? What's the justification for playing a video before the defendant opens the door on the interrogation techniques dimension? What's the justification for playing a video that's got statements in it like, I think you're lying, or there's overwhelming evidence of guilt, why don't you just tell the truth?
Well,
I understand your opening the door argument, but where's the cart and where's the horse?
Well, that's true, but the prosecutor has a right to bring in the defendant's statements made during the interrogation and has a right to show the entire interrogation such that the defendant's body language.
He doesn't have a right to show the entire interrogation if it included, as Judge Daly suggested, blatantly improper statements like, well, you already failed your polygraph.
Correct.
So what's the people's justification for the portions of the interview tape that the jury heard that contain statements like, I've got massive evidence against you?
Well, there was, as this court's aware, there was no objection, there was no request to have the videotape redacted so that that wasn't in, that so that that didn't come in. But, I mean,
Is there a plausible ground upon which it could have come in? I think that's part of the question that...
Well, under Davis, I believe there is.
And what is that ground?
The court in Davis affirmed admission of the detective's testimony that he became confrontational with witnesses during the interviews because he did not think that they were being truthful. I mean...
What was the Supreme Court's rationale for allowing that evidence in that case?
Because it provides context for the detective's tactics. I mean, if a jury's going to see this kind of behavior by the detective, they need to know why the detective is doing that, and it provides the context for it, and that's what the Supreme Court said was okay in Davis.
Yeah, the Supreme Court did not endorse a rule saying that detectives can opine or that evidence would be admissible to show that the defendant was lying on another occasion.
That's correct.
It's not admissible for that purpose.
Correct. It only comes in to provide context for the interrogating tactics, not directly going to the credibility or the detective commenting on the credibility of the witness.
Counsel, can I ask you about a different area?
Yes.
Concerning this veracity evidence, and that is the forensic interviewer. When the court propounds a question to the forensic interviewer, in your experience, you found that children lied during my interview, or during an interview, in my experience. We're not asking you for an opinion in this case, but in just general terms. In general terms, no. That was his answer, or her answer, I'm not sure.
I think it was a he.
Why is that different from People versus Snook, where the Supreme Court said that the witness cannot testify that children tend not to fabricate stories of sexual abuse?
Because, well, that one statement is taken a little bit out of context because there was a follow-up question after that. And she says, or he says, it is not my job, specifically, it is not my job as a forensic interviewer to determine whether or not a child is lying. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. I'm just there to get...
And I understand how that may mitigate the earlier testimony, but actually, it's not my job to determine whether a child is lying, but in general, children don't lie. So you draw your own inferences from this jury. Why is that? Why is the testimony that was presented by a witness different from that in People versus Snook, which is that children tend not to fabricate stories of sexual abuse? They tend not to lie about sexual abuse. And remember, in that one, the Supreme Court said, well, that's problematic because what it says to the jury is, well, the victim's almost certainly telling the truth. Whether or not we're pinpointing this victim, children in general don't lie, so
right.
Draw your own inferences.
Because I think that it was everything that this expert witness said was tailored toward generalities and...
Snook was too, generalities. Okay, so that's not going to help us make a distinction.
That, taken alone, possibly that was not proper, but I think when you've got the follow-up answer and you've got all of the other testimony by that particular witness, particularly at the beginning of his testimony where he said, you know, I'm a blind witness, meaning I don't know anything about this case. I make a point of not knowing anything about this case. And then just talking about in generalities, I just don't think that it rises to the level of plain error.
One other question I asked.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Thank you. How old were these children when they were interviewed by the forensic interviewer?
I want to say they were 8 and...
When they were interviewed?
Oh, I'm sorry, when they were interviewed. They were 15 or 16 and 13 or 12.
Okay.
I don't know if... I'm sorry.
Well, finish your answer, Judge Daly's question.
No, I was going to move on. So
well,
if you...
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned plain error. Didn't defendant preserve the objection to the children don't usually lie question?
You may be correct, Your Honor, that Because it was a jury question, if I remember.
It was a question from the juror, I believe.
And then maybe I think you're right that the defense attorney did object to one of the two questions, and then the court may have gone ahead and asked the question. So I apologize.
All right, move on.
So it wouldn't be. I don't know if the court has any specific questions on any of the other topics, but as far as a speedy trial is concerned, I don't think the statute could be any more clear that to be entitled to dismissal, you have to move for dismissal before the trial starts. And defense counsel did not do that. But regardless, even if they had moved for dismissal, there's no question that SP was a material witness, probably the most important witness, or that there were reasonable grounds to believe that she would be available for a rescheduled trial date. She had a doctor's note. I mean, I don't know what more the prosecution could have done as far as having good reason to request the continuance. So I do not believe the court used its discretion in granting a short continuance. I don't know if there are any other questions that the court has on the other topics.
Do you remember what opposing counsel had to say about prosecutorial closing arguments? Do you have any response to his argument about that?
Your Honor, I believe that, again, it was general comments on Ms. Adala, as you know, wrote this brief, and it was general comments on witness credibility. There was no personal opinion by the prosecutor injected into the closing argument. Every one of the arguments was tied to the evidence that was admitted in the case. You know, how the victims measured up the tests of credibility set forth in the instructions. Discussing the victim's demeanor on the stand. Discussing why victims delay reporting. Because all of those things are used by the defense to say they're not telling the truth because they did these things.
Well, he also mentioned, and actually he dwelled on, the prosecutor's comment about sympathy or statement, sympathy. And he suggests that the law is very clear that it's not proper to appeal to the jury on the basis of sympathy.
Well, I think the word sympathy was actually used to talk about everyone. There's a lot of people that feel sorry for, including the mom and even the defendant. I mean, I don't think it was geared just towards the girl. It was more of a general statement. And again, it was not objected to. So unless the court has any other questions, I would ask that you affirm defendant's convictions and sentence. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course. Let me check with my colleagues.